I'm still having connected to this caller, and I was looking.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to call to order the House Subcommittee on Higher Education. Thanks for being here. We've got lots of things to cover today. We're going to start off with a hearing on House Bill 3418. Later on in our agenda, we're hoping to do a work session on House Bill 2728. I think we can move that out of the committee today, and then the majority of our time will be focused on a comparisons of Senate Bill 242 and House Bill 2118 with the reorganization of our OUS system and so forth and so on. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3418. And it's my understanding that Co-Chair Dimbro is going to provide some testimony on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, honorable colleagues. I'm Michael Dimbro, State Representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose, and I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3418. Colleagues, we are in the midst of some truly historic conversations around expanding access to higher education in this state. We as a committee have talked about a variety of issues in pursuit of this agenda, making textbooks more affordable. We've talked about 40-40-20. We've talked about dual credit. We've talked about Aspire. We've talked about articulation and transfer between the community colleges and the universities. And next week we'll be talking about a proposed Oregon student articulation, I'm sorry, what is it? The transfer, Oregon Transfer Student Bill of Rights. We've heard about the governor's vision of integrating higher education into a seamless continuum. On the opening day of this session, we joined the Senate in public hearings on Senate Bill 242, which has just passed out of the Senate Education Committee, and which we'll be examining closely today. This bill was the product of the bicameral, bipartisan work group on higher education that was created late last spring to examine strategic plans coming out of OUS and some of the universities. This bill, Senate Bill 242, will restructure our higher education enterprise so that all of post-secondary education can do its work jointly and strategically. It gives the universities and the State Board of Higher Education more flexibility in a variety of areas so that more resources and more attention can be put directly into instruction and student support, giving the universities the ability to more quickly and nimbly adjust to changing conditions. In shifting OUS from being a state agency with the restrictions and regulations that that status entails to being a public university system with much more discretion over how it deploys its resources, we are in effect lightening the hand of the legislature over the daily operations of our universities. But that doesn't mean that we're releasing them from their obligations as public universities. We are not. We have to remain exceedingly clear on what we continue to expect from our universities and our community colleges in performing their public mission for Oregonians. We must maintain oversight mechanisms that will guarantee ongoing affordability, access, and success for Oregon students, and clarity that our colleges and universities are benefiting Oregon through their research enterprises and their ability to create a skilled workforce with the ability to think critically and to be engaged civically. Senate Bill 242 envisions the universities entering into performance compacts with the legislature regarding their commitment to following through on their public mission and their success in meeting those goals. At this point, though, it only speaks of these compacts in very general terms. The compacts will need to be fleshed out and approved by the legislature before the new relationship envisioned in Senate Bill 242 can begin. This companion bill, House Bill 3418, creates the process for clarifying the legislature's expectations defining the mechanisms for measuring success, and creating methods of incentivizing and rewarding it. Measuring the number of Oregonians who gain access to higher education is relatively easy. Measuring success, on the other hand, requires the establishment of strategic goals and metrics that have yet to be determined. The process envisioned in House Bill 3418 will develop those goals and metrics across the entire spectrum of higher education, respecting both the commonalities and the uniquenesses in mission of the various institutions and sectors. In addition, many states are beginning to look at funding their institutions in a different way. Instead of basing allocations exclusively on student headcount and FTE, a portion of their allocations would create rewards and incentives for student and institutional success. Here in Oregon, we currently have no way to reward those institutions that are doing an effective job of creating success. This method, our current method of allocating funds, creates an incentive for colleges and universities to enroll students, but no fiscal incentive for those institutions to help students complete their courses, move on to a second year, earn degrees, and otherwise meet their goals. That must change. It would be a mistake, however, to measure success by focusing exclusively on degree and certificate attainment. Some people go directly there, but that only tells one piece of the overall higher education story. Certificates and degrees are important and the primary goal of post-secondary education, but they are not the only measure of an institution's success in meeting its larger public mission. We need to make sure that the degrees and certificates are in areas that meet Oregon's workforce needs. We need to make sure that they are programs of high quality. We need to make sure that institutions are reaching out to non-traditional students, casting their enrollment nets broadly, bringing in low-income and first-generation college attendees, supporting them, retaining them, making sure that they learn. There's been a great deal of work done around the country and in this state to pinpoint real-world markers of success. Success will be measured differently for the community colleges, the regional universities, and the research universities, and for different disciplines within those institutions and sectors, according to their respective missions. An array of different metrics will be needed to gauge success. We will need a proactive, evidence-based process to develop and recommend those metrics to the legislature. It will require participation from faculty, other staff, and students at the institutions, along with representatives of business, industry, legislators, and the general public, as well as specialists from OUS and CCWD. They will need to examine the growing national literature on college completion, remediation, and different funding models. They will need to look at the work that has already been done in this state by OUS and CCWD and bring it together in a comprehensive way. House Bill 3418, the Higher Education Student and Institutional Success Act, will establish a task force to create the performance metrics that we need in order to implement the reorganization, and will make recommendations to the legislature. The task force will be staffed by the Joint Boards of Education. These recommendations will include, but not be limited to, metrics reflecting the following considerations: the extent to which institutions are moving us closer to achieving the goal of 40-40-20. Multiple measures and effective programs for assessing student success and completion and institutional performance success. Removing barriers to student access, success, and completion, including institutional and statutory barriers. Best practices for promoting student access, success, and completion, including the acquisition of basic skills and career preparation skills. Demonstrated success in effectively managing public resources. alternative funding options for providing necessary services to students and promoting best practices for student success and completion. And alternative funding options instituted in other states for improving student success and completion. Several other states have been moving down this road, notably Tennessee, Ohio, and California's just beginning. And I asked Anna to forward you all a presentation that was done by the people from Tennessee about what they are trying to do in terms of success-based funding. And I encourage you to take a look at that. As part of its work, the task force will facilitate discussions with key higher education stakeholders at the institutional and board levels, as well as hold public hearings to provide input on the findings and recommendations of the task force. It will review work done by previous OUS and CCWD committees and task forces in Oregon, as well as by relevant professional organizations and in other states. The bill will require the task force to give periodic updates to the interim House Subcommittee on Higher Education and the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development, and to report its recommendations to the appropriate legislative committees by December 31st of 2011. This timeline will allow the 2012 legislature the ability to consider the recommendations and adopt an initial version of the Performance Compact in time for the full implementation of Senate Bill 242 on July 1st, 2012, and for the development of the next biennial budget. Colleagues, I'm very excited about the work that this task force will do. It will be looking at these very important issues in a thorough, thoughtful, deliberative manner, with the work flowing from the ground up. This is precisely what we need if we are to create a collaborative, success-oriented, supportive climate for higher education in this state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lindsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just finished reading this again. I just wanted to clarify my understanding that Section 2 of the bill is the provision that would allow this task force to just self-dissolve. What I mean is that Section 1 of this act is repealed on the date of the convening.
This is not a standing task force.
So
it's a short term.
Self-dissolve.
Correct.
So is that, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. We will have to make an amendment in the dates, though. I had initially, when I developed this, thought that it would do its work over a two-year period. But it seems vital that we get its work done in time for the reorganization that happens. We don't want to, you know, for example, if we decide to create a coordinating commission for higher education and change the status of OUS from being a state agency to a public university system, these have to be in place before that can begin. That, I think, is critical for us as a legislature to have the agreement clear and in writing. So, hence, things are moved up. We'll have to be moved up a little.
Sure.
Yeah.
Representative Dembro, would 3418 require the existence of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and Senate Bill 242 in order for it to be able to function?
You know, I think that it is going to be, the short answer is no. It will need to be there, I believe, to do the other part of Senate Bill 242, that is the change from the state agency to public university. And also, if we are going to be serious about looking forward to potentially funding for performance, then, you know, it's really vital that this work begin.
That was one of my other questions about the performance metric, if you will. That's not necessarily a part of this as you're outlining it. Is that correct?
No, it is. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess what I'm getting to is tying performance perhaps to economic relationships between the OUS system, the university, between the legislature and the OUS system, if you will. Degrees, types of degrees, all those systems, somehow
success
some sort
metrics.
Of exactly that could be possibly tied to economic factors as well in regards to funding from the legislature, funding from the state to the Oregon University system.
Yeah, I encourage you to take a look at what Tennessee is doing. Mm-hmm. What they're doing is they're looking at they're looking forward, and they, like we, are unhappy with their current level of funding of higher education. But as they are looking for additional dollars being allocated from their legislature, they want to tie those additional dollars to performance metrics that they've come to consensus on. So there would then be a very direct kind of relationship between additional funding and performance.
Okay.
With the goal, again, of incentivizing successful practices.
Sure. Okay. Great. Questions? Brett Parker?
Quick question for you, Mr. Chair. This, Mr. Chair. I see some students here. Do we have faculty members who are going to be testifying today also?
Not faculty. We have Bridget Burns and Cam Prius also. Cam's not testifying.
Yeah,
yet.
Okay, then.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Yes, sir.
Please. I have heard, and I imagine that all of us have heard, some concerns from the student and faculty organizations that we not be turning our higher ed institutions into diploma mills, for instance, that these metrics might encourage enhancement of certain departments, elimination of other departments, et cetera. Since the students are here, they will, I am sure, be able to talk about their concerns. But since I have heard that from some faculty, and they do not appear to be here, maybe you might offer any comments that you have along those lines.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Rep. Parker and Mr. Chair. I think the design of this bill is actually to address those concerns. That is, the metrics, as I indicated, the goal is for the metrics to be created from the ground up and to be much more, subtle and comprehensive than just looking at degrees. And so I think, frankly, I think that's the real merit of doing it this way, as opposed to one or two people sitting down and creating KPMs that in many cases don't really align with the real world needs of students and faculty.
What further questions? We have some further testimony. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Chair, I'd like to recognize Representative Clem, who's joining us too. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Had an afternoon off, did you?
Oh, I have a few opinions on a topic later, I think.
Okay, great.
I'd listen.
Love to have you weigh in as you feel led to. Thank you. Bridget Burns, would you like to testify, and Cam too?
And Cam.
And Cam Prius as well, please.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for the time to speak. My name is Bridget Burns. I'm the Chief of Staff of the Oregon University System. I just wanted to offer some brief remarks about this legislation. The first, I want to acknowledge that the Oregon University System has a longstanding commitment to student success, and I think that we have a few recent developments to really point towards to demonstrate that. The first of which is that we have a Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives who works on this all quite a bit. In 2008, started the Office of Student Success Initiatives, and so we have an entire office that is focused on these kind of cultivation of excellent outcomes for students. Further, we also developed the Interinstitutional Council on Enrollment Management. And as a result of some of these policies and these developed focused resources, we have record enrollment, we have record retention, we are seeing steady increases and consistent highs in our six-year graduation rate, and we think that there are just a lot of things to be proud of that we're accomplishing within the university system. And as Representative Dembro talked about some of the performance outcomes that we've been developing, as you can see, we're already holding ourselves to a very high standard and willing to be very accountable for these things. We do think that the new diploma standard is going to do a lot for this, and we also think our new automatic admission policy is going to be helpful. So we are deeply committed to this issue and share your concern. Happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss. I'm the director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Good morning, or good afternoon, Chair Johnson and members. I, too, want to add my voice of congratulations, perhaps, to Representative Dembro for proposing a task force. As Bridget has outlined, there has been a good bit of work that has been done, and some of it has been done across the sectors, and some of it has been within the sectors. I do think that the community colleges, since about 2008, have been working on what are the definitions of success for students if it's not always a degree or a certificate. And so we have actually spent a good bit of time doing research from national experts and bringing it back to Oregon and, if you will, trying it on and seeing if it will work for us, if we can collect the data to actually see where momentum points are for students if they are shy of a certificate or a degree and would be most willing to sit down and share what we have learned if this task force is formed and be able to have some congruence and work toward congruence between the sectors and the performance that we are reporting.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. I just must truth in advertising or truth in lending. I first really became aware of this issue and thinking about metrics in a in a subtle, comprehensive way through being on that task force that Cam mentioned back in 2008. I had to step down from it to take this lesser job here, but I learned an awful lot from that. It was very useful.
One question I would have is that. Is that of communication or the interaction between this task force, if you will, the State Board of Higher Ed, the Chancellor, the potential for an Higher Ed Coordinating Commission? Who's accountable to who? Who answers to who? And how does this function in a way that makes sense?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, just to clarify, are you asking for this specific task force or the performance indicators that are articulated?
This task force. Directly to the legislature?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yes, Chair Johnson, I think the bill calls out the joint boards of education as they currently exist, or any successor entity, to be responsible for making sure that the report is done and brought to the legislature. So I actually think that without other structures in place, the joint boards of education does a very good job of convening across the sectors to be responsive to legislative requests.
Okay. As I look down the makeup of the potential members, line 19 would be letter K of section 1 calls for one member who is a representative of a labor union that represents employees at a state institution. Just curious about why that would be a need as we're talking about measuring academic performance, degree performance, that sort of thing, why that would be a valuable member of this committee.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I would defer to Representative Dembro on that issue.
Yes, I drafted this.
Okay.
The reason is that would be a way for us to assure the participation of staff who are, represented by a union. In our most of our community colleges and universities, their staff is represented by a union, and this would be a way that they are the recognized representatives of the employees with their administrations. And very often when we have these kinds of task forces, that's where such representation comes from.
I appreciate that, I guess, but we do have other faculty represented who I assume would be members of those representative unions as well, so I guess I'm just curious about, in terms of really digging deep and being willing to drill down and get to the baseline of what we're trying to accomplish and provide real objective measurements, metrics, if you will, about the performances, so just something that piques my attention.
If I could respond, there are many people within our colleges and universities who are not faculty, but who who are very, important for assuring student success. You know, counselors, academic advisors, financial aid specialists, and they may not be faculty, but their voice is going to be very important in this conversation. So, and you know, especially also as we are looking at, the viability of the institutions in general, that they do important work.
Representative Hoyle.
In my district, although my district is very close to the University of Oregon because of the district I represent and the demographics, if somebody is in my district and they're at the University of Oregon or at Lane, it is generally because they're a classified worker or they're the first person in their family to go to college, because usually when people get degrees and they get jobs where they're earning more money, they move out of my district. It's a great district. I love my people. But so the bottom line is that the needs, the interest, and quite frankly, the perspective of someone who is a faculty member and a professor is not the same as the needs, the perspective, and of someone who is a classified worker. And again, they have a different interaction with the students. They have a different perspective, and they offer something of value. And I think having their voice at the table is certainly important, and it does go to benefit. We have to look at this holistically, and I think if you leave someone out of the conversation, the chance of getting everyone on board to get a good solution is it makes it more difficult.
My questions weren't to leave anyone out. I guess the language talks about a member who is a representative. Perhaps that just has different connotations than just simply an employee who happens to be a classified employee or a licensed employee. So that's just the way it strikes me. So I'm not saying it's a huge issue.
And let me say, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, having been through a number of task force bills over the last couple of sessions, usually once they're out there, then the sponsor starts getting calls from different people and organizations. How about us? How come we're not on? Add us. And so I expect that fully. But please be gentle. We can't put everybody on this task force. It's got to be a manageable number be able to do its work.
Thank you.
One other question I'd have would be, is the metrics that we're trying to examine, is there, and either one of the three of you feel free to weigh in, but would be the cost, as we're talking about institutional costs and so forth, and examining, increases, obviously, in the cost of the diplomas and the cost of the education for students, and what are those driving factors within the university system that perhaps could be looked at, and we could look for efficiencies, I guess. Is that a part of the metrics that would be examined by this task force?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's what I was thinking of with the item that I mentioned about effective use of public resources. That would be something that would be looked at.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions about 3418? Thank you. Emma Calloway would like to come forward now and address perhaps some student perspective.
I have one other question.
Certainly.
About the faculty. Has there been significant, during the process, was there significant input from the faculty and faculty organizations to indicate that they will participate in this? I'm asking because on the other side of my life, the day job, I interact with an organization that meets in D.C. three times a year, and each university is supposed to send three different representatives, one of whom is faculty. They frequently have a very hard time getting a faculty member to step up for these positions. I'm happy to see the faculty listed on this, but has this been discussed?
Yep. Mr. Chair, I've talked to several different faculty organizations. They're very interested in being part of this.
Good. Yeah. Thanks.
Emma? Great. Good afternoon, co-chairs Johnson and Dembro. Thanks for having us here today. My students are going to testify on some later bills, and I just wanted to give a brief overview of where we're at with 3418 and bring a couple things to your attention. So first of all, we believe that this is an integral part of restructuring, and we really applaud Representative Dembro and appreciate your leadership on going forward with the performance metrics, because we believe that it's an important aspect of 242 is making sure we have an accountable system, and you'll probably hear that as a continued theme of the Oregon Student Association is accountability. The only thing that we have concern with, first off, just to kind of lead with that and move on, is traditionally when we see a committee put together like this and we see one community college and one university student represented, we often will say that that causes us some concern for a rural or a smaller school versus a larger school being represented in each of those categories. And we've already heard comments being made that we need to make sure that we are aware of the size of this committee, but often with the Oregon University system, there's some trade-off that's done between making sure that both of those groups, and we asked for this in the Coordinating Commission bill as well, that both groups are represented, both small and large community colleges and universities, and those different groups are represented. We do think that if this is going to go any further into talking specifically about issues that the performance metrics would talk about, we would want to see tuition affordability as one of the top priorities, accountability with elected officials. That's often a theme of the Oregon Student Association. We believe that we're talking a lot with our faculty right now, and we want quality to be a very important part of the performance metrics that are talked about, and if that could be more explicit in this bill, that would be wonderful, because quality does address some of those concerns that Representative Harker brought up in terms of being a diploma mill, and believe that when we achieve high quality education, that we're less concerned about the numbers that we're churning out, because we do think that educating more Oregonians is an incredibly valuable part of this piece as well. Let's see. I think that's all we have to say for now. We wanted to bring up the rural versus large school, definitely talk about quality and tuition affordability, but in general, we're going to take an official stance on this bill, but as it's an incredibly integral part of 242, which we already unanimously support, we wanted to put forward our gratitude on this bill and take any questions you may have from the students.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks, Emma.
Thanks for being here.
Okay, got it. All right, well, thank you. We'll go ahead and close our public hearing then on House Bill 3418. Should we do our work session now? We're good to go. You're okay with your timing?
Yeah, do you want Sherry? Is she going to be here?
She will be here at some point. I don't know exactly when. We could put that public hearing or the work session at the end of our agenda. That's possible.
Well, we could vote on
it. You have to take off also, correct?
I do have to take off, and I just got a message from my staff that it's probably going to be pretty soon. So I don't know how long.
Why don't we go ahead and
we could vote, and then
we can
give her the ability to cast her vote after.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go ahead and open up then a work session on House Bill 2728, and I'll refer to Anna to get us queued up.
Deborah Buchanan is going to explain the Dash 2
amendment. Okay. Deborah Buchanan, would you come forward, please, in from the Department of Revenue and explain some differences between our Dash 1 amendments that we already have adopted and I think the suggested Dash 2 amendments to this bill.
Maybe you should explain the bill.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue.
Let's go ahead and let Anna just give us a view up on what we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2728 expands current statute to allow taxpayers to make direct deposit contributions of all or a portion of income tax refund into the Oregon 529 College Savings Network account. Contribution forms are to be filed with the tax return each year, applies to income tax refunds payable to taxpayers for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2011. Takes effect on the 91st day of the following adjournment, sine die.
Okay.
Thank you. The Dash 2 amendment, Mr. Chair, I believe the only difference is you'll notice lines 6 and 7 of the Dash 2. What we noticed was the language in the Dash 1 that was approved addressed the year in which a direct deposit of a contribution can apply. And as it was written in the Dash 1, it said it may be applied as a contribution only for the tax year for which the refund is issued. So, if, for example, if I had a refund coming in April of 2011 when I filed my 2010 return, this would have meant the contribution would be for the 2010 return. And what it really needed to say is what it says in the Dash 2, is it may be applied as a contribution only for the tax year in which the refund is issued. So if the refund comes in 2011, it would be a contribution for 2011. Thank you.
Seems pretty cut and dried to me. Is that Do you have any questions about the logic behind the dash two?
Not questions. I'm really glad it got caught because otherwise
words
we would have
powerful.
Been in
trouble. Okay. Okay.
Perfect.
Perfect timing. Let Rep Springer get settled in. Is there a further discussion about the amendments? If not, we just
Just a tactical question. You go over here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my assumption is just, so I get in my little tax cut software, which I just did my taxes after the reconnect went through. And at the end of it, all you do, you can check all the boxes of charities that you want to give additional to political parties. I'm assuming this is where we would put that check box. Or
Mr. Is that
Chair. How it works?
Representative Lindsay, we haven't actually designed the form yet or determined that that's where it would be. We also have a line there for entering direct deposit information, a bank account number. So it may be a part of that. It may be a part of the section on charitable contributions. We haven't quite figured that out yet because we've got a little bit of time to do that. But the idea is I have a refund coming. I can indicate that all or part of that refund goes to 529 plan instead of coming to me as a check or instead of going into my personal bank account.
And just as a follow-up, I'm assuming the question I haven't had answered yet is what if 529 does not exist yet? I'm assuming you have to have an existing account before you can deposit it, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, yes, that is one of the items that we asked to have included in the bill was that the account needs to be established already, that it wouldn't be up to us to try to figure out whether there is an account.
Everybody okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, then I have a motion.
Representative Dimbrough.
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2728.
Representative Dimbrough moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the Dash 1 amendments or House Bill 2728. Is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, the motion is agreed to. The rules are suspended.
Mm-hmm. Great. In that case, Chair Johnson, I move that we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments dated February 23rd, 2011 were adopted.
Representative Dimbrough moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/23/11. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the motion is agreed to.
Chair Johnson. I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, dated March 3rd, 2011.
Rep. Dimbrough moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, dated 3/3/11. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, so moved. That worked really well.
Finally, Mr. Chair, it's my pleasure to move House Bill 2728 as amended to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbrough has moved House Bill 2728 as amended to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, so moved. Very good.
Yep.
And now we'll close the work session. This interminable work session on House Bill 2728. Great work. Okay, at this point in time, I'd love to open this is going to be an informational hearing on the two pieces of legislation before this legislature that would address our higher ed system. We're going to have a comparison between Senate Bill 242 and House Bill 2118. And I'd love to start this discussion with Bridget Burns, representing the OUS system.
Ch-
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Bridget Burns. I'm the Chief of Staff of the Oregon University System. And to my left is the legal counsel for the Oregon University System, Ryan Hegeman. He will be here to answer any questions you might have about the amendments that are currently in 242. However, today what I'm going to talk to you about are the two pieces of legislation, House Bill 2118 and Senate Bill 242. I'm going to talk to you about the process that led to the development of both of these pieces of legislation, folks who were consulted, considerations along the way. I'm going to talk to you about two really important and meaningful outcomes that I think I want to highlight, the first of which is the tuition setting process, and the second of which Representative Denbrough recently spoke to you about in terms of the performance compact. I'm then going to talk to you about just the actual components of 2118, and finally 242, talk to you about those brief differences and those groups that have offered support. I know that there are going to be other speakers today who are going to lend their support and articulate concerns they might have, but along the way, please feel free to interrupt me. You have a few handouts, the first of which is a summary comparison of House Bill 2118 and Senate Bill 242, as well as the amendments for each portion, so that will hopefully be helpful. The first thing I want to point out is that the State Board of Higher Education developed a governance committee that was really focused on two primary questions back in 2009. Those questions were, how do we best achieve the goals of the 40-40-20, and how do we move the educational attainment levels of this state? So that was those were the primary questions and the drivers for all of this. And ultimately, we determined that there were some potential cost savings that could be gained if we had a little bit more flexibility for all of our institutions. And they started a process that lasted all of last year and is still going on, where they brought in constituents, they brought in students, faculty, anyone who was going to be affected. It was in public meetings. We had a very comprehensive process where we debated and vetted any possible policy outcomes, concerns along the way, and basically came up with a solution that has been uniformly supported by all seven university presidents, by the State Board of Higher Education, and the business community, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Now, that group in July of 2010 was that proposal came out of the State Board of Higher Education. It's the OUS governance proposal. That proposal went before the interim work group, of which members of this committee served on. Now, that work group contemplated a variety of measures and a variety of ideas that have been brought forth in the state, but one of them was the governance proposal from OUS. And ultimately, that group, after it met with national experts and looked at best practices, looked at comparisons of similar states and where how we wanted to achieve our goals, they voted for what you see in Senate Bill 242. However, House Bill 2118 is essentially in full form the OUS governance proposal. So one thing that I want to point out that is comprehensive in both of these bills that I think is a tremendous source of pride for Oregon and especially for OUS, and that is the proposed tuition setting process. Right now when tuition is set, it is essentially worked out at the institution level and it depends on the campus. But what we wanted to do was really drive that process down to the folks who are affected and allow them to have a meaningful contribution to that process. So what we've done is designed a process that would be going beginning in the fall of each campus, and that would be comprised of at least 50% students. It would have faculty on it and administrators, and they will walk through the budget of the university, of the tuition that was set the previous year, why they got to that conclusion, and ultimately what the number should be for the next year. Because we think that there shouldn't be mystery about tuition, that it's a very practical thing and it's a necessary thing in order for us to fully fund these institutions to educate students. And we want to make sure that students are fully aware of it and they want to have their voice in that process. When we're talking about setting tuition, it's important to note that really there are very few drivers, but they are kind of set in stone for our universities. 80% of the cost of educating a student is essentially set for us, and that is faculty and employee costs. It's PEB, PERS, tenured faculty. We don't have a lot of flexibility there. So the remaining 20% is where we have to deal with things such as services, supplies, utilities, buildings and how we keep the educational enterprise going. We have very little flexibility, but we noticed that in that remaining 20%, if we had some additional flexibility from the state in terms of procuring risk management and having our own department, having our own legal counsel in-house, we would be able to save some money. But knowing that we have limited flexibility right now, and our costs continue to go up, such as if there's a PEB increase of 10%, that translates across the board to a 2% tuition increase. Because if we're not getting additional funding from the state, the only other alternative is to work with students to find a tuition number. So what I would say is that this tuition process is something that is very Oregon. It is about letting the people who are affected have an actual valuable input on the outcome, and it's something that the Oregon Student Association worked closely with us in developing. Now, both Senate Bill 242 and 2118 feature this, and we think that this is important because each campus should really own their tuition number, and we should also talk about important things like need-based aid in response to it. The second thing that I want to point out that Representative Dembrough spoke about is the performance compact. We want to be accountable for important outcomes that we think will have a measurable impact in the educational attainment of this state. So we have articulated different measures that we're going to work out with, hopefully, you all, to identify how we can measure our performance. And so when we come to you for money, when we come in the Ways and Means process, this would be front and center in terms of saying, this is how much money you gave us. These are the number of degrees we awarded in STEM areas. These are the number of degrees we were awarded in rural areas. This is the enrollment we had. These are the different measures that you can look at and gauge our success. And then we work with you to set future goals for ourselves, and we hold ourselves accountable because we think that we produce such important outcomes for this state that we want to be more open and transparent about those outcomes, and we want to be, frankly, we're proud of the job we're doing, and we think that that's how we should be funded, is based on the excellent work and the excellent outputs that we're providing for Oregonians. So some of those areas are access and participation. We can look at headcount enrollment and undergraduate geographic regions of the state, how we educate our citizenry, workforce enhancement, access and affordability, graduate success, efficient fiscal stewardship, knowledge creation and innovation, and quality. And I gave you a handout that provides you with some real meaningful comparisons of where we are currently on a lot of these measures, how we would be able to measure some of these outcomes, and we also show how, if we're going to be planning in the future, where we need to be focusing our resources. And that's in the Governance Policy Committee Performance Compact document. So the Performance Compact and the tuition process are both major wins for Oregon, and they're present in both pieces of legislation. I'm going to now talk about House Bill 2118, which is functionally the OUS governance proposal. There are some really important gains for this proposal, and I want to be very clear about this. This proposal and 242 are the biggest changes for Oregon higher education since we developed the state system of higher education in 1929. We have never done anything this big, and that's why, as you can see, as we gain flexibility, the values of this group that developed this proposal are showing through. Instead of just gaining flexibility, we're trying to increase our accountability, increase our transparency, and increase the voice of the folks who are affected in all of the processes that we manage. The first thing is tuition interest earnings. Now, this is something that working families who are putting their students through college, low-income Oregonians, and especially the business community as well, noticed that this would be important, that currently the interest earnings gathered from tuition dollars invested from families is not used in higher education. It goes into the general fund. And it makes sense that we should be able to use that money, and we have committed that all of those tuition interest earnings will go towards need-based aid. So we think that those students, the interest that's garnered should be focused on educational outcomes, and we think that that's an important commitment that all of our presidents have made. The second meaningful change is expenditure limitation. And I've talked to you, each of you, about this process and some of the impediments that come with it. Expenditure limitation is essentially that we have to ask in order to spend the tuition dollars that families and students are giving us on those students. And that becomes a problem because over time, we're not able to plan for the future. We're always kind of trying to get expenditure limitation for last term. And it creates major flexibility problems for for us. It makes it very difficult for us to manage our cost and make strategic investments. A really good example is this past year. We have all-time high enrollment, and as a result, we had more tuition dollars than we had previously asked for, because when the economy's down, more students come in, and so that happened, but we have more costs as a result, because those students are, we need to educate them. We need to hire more faculty and staff, open up more courses so that we can meet their needs. But if we had been appropriated a certain expenditure amount and we had to go over it, well, we had a problem. So we had to come to the E-Board and ask for an expenditure limitation of $17 million. Now, the E-Board in December deferred making a decision on that and waited until earlier, about 2 weeks ago, I believe. And they decided to support that. But here's the problem that brings for me is that those students persisted for an entire another term. So $17 million was what we needed in the fall. Now we need $29 million. So that's more money that families are giving us to educate their children, and we can't spend it on them today. We think that long term this will allow for us to be able to make smart investments of how we manage our costs. And we think that ultimately we want to be able to spend the money that families are putting towards the education of their students actually towards that end. So expenditure limitation flexibility is what we're seeking, and it seems to also have strong support from folks across the board that we've met with. We would gain some freedom from the Department of Justice and be able to do our own legal counsel in-house, which I'm happy to speak about that more. We obviously face very specific legal concerns running campuses. We have very specific types of issues that we face, and we're willing to take on that responsibility. We would also be able to procure another area of savings is risk management cost savings. We would save $2 million a year if we could be able to negotiate for our own risk management. Again, the types of risks that are borne by universities is functionally different than other state agencies. And therefore, if we can bundle with other universities or university systems of similar size, we can achieve dramatic cost savings that we can then use for educational outcomes, such as more, you know, financial aid. We can be able to plug that money back in, which we make that commitment later on, where we talk about how we're also, on that same token, we're going to commit that we're going to be covering 12% of unmet need for our students, which, you know, previously we haven't made that commitment. We're going to, which for need and unmet need, the clarification there is unmet need exists when we've already taken a stab at their need. We've already given them grants and scholarships. And at the end of it all, after they've gotten their Pell Grant and any other supplemental help, we then will take an additional stab at it. So that's something that we're you're also gaining. Finally, you'll see that we're changing what we are, which is now a public university system. We're keeping our public nature, but we are not functionally the same as other state agencies, and therefore we are just asking for additional flexibility to be able to manage based similar to how the K-12 system and the community colleges operate. We will remain subject to Secretary of State audits, Treasury, MWESB, Ethics Commission, Central Government, etc. We're not asking for any less transparency. In fact, I would argue that we are giving far more in exchange for this flexibility. We're going to have improved accountability. We're going to have public records, meetings, transparent processes about tuition setting that, frankly, is unprecedented in Oregon, but I think nationally you will see very few states where students play such a vital role and such a meaningful role that is acknowledged by in the rules of the university system. State audits, state ethics, administrative rules. The board is still approved by the governor and the Senate, and so ultimately this body, this legislative body, will have tremendous input into who serves on that oversight board that then hires the chancellor and hires the presidents of the universities. And we will also put front and center accountability. If you give us this flexibility, then whenever we come back to Ways and Means, we are going to show you how we spent the money, and we're going to have serious, meaningful conversations about how we should in the future, and we're going to be totally accountable for it. One of the benefits we're going to see is that there's going to be improved planning. There will be no fund sweeps or fund shifts, as they've been referred to in the past. We won't have limits on how we can spend the money that students are giving us to be educated today. We're going to have better control over our costs to be able to lower tuition, and that's going to be a really meaningful outcome that I think that you'll see from students. The board is going to be better able to control the system and its universities, and we'll be able to be responsive to the needs of the state. So that's 2118. And essentially, when you think about 242, realize that it has essentially been swallowed in swallowed 2118. Aside from two changes, 242 has two substantial changes that I'll talk about now, which is it encompasses the entire OUS governance proposal. It adds a coordinating board that oversees the community colleges and Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and it also the one thing it doesn't do is it doesn't require a study of local or institutional boards. The one thing in the OUS governance proposal that came forward was some of our presidents want to have a meaningful conversation about institutional boards and how we are governed. And we, just so you know, regardless of what comes forward in this legislation, the State Board of Higher Education has made a commitment that we are going to have a very public, deliberative, thoughtful, and inclusive process over the next year where we are going to have constituents at the table and we are going to deeply investigate whether or not local boards or institutional boards are the right option for Oregon. What institutions might want them, if they were to be composed, what would they look like? But my main point would be that this issue has definitely not been vetted. It has not been discussed at an extensive level. And we think that in order to achieve meaningful change in Oregon, you need to go through the process that we did for our governance committee and our governance proposal, because it leads to outcomes like this, where we have near uniform support for Senate Bill 242 or House Bill 2118, because we took the time to listen to every constituent and have and make meaningful changes that would be responsive to those concerns. So there's no study of local boards in House Bill and Senate Bill 242. Regardless, we're going to have that conversation internally, and we'd be happy to report back to the legislature on that. The other component is the coordinating board, and I think that there are some interested parties here today who are going to talk about how that will benefit us or concerns they might have. What the national experts said when they came before the interim work group, and if you look at some of the comparative data out there, you'll see Oregon is surprisingly incredibly effective at transferring students between community colleges and the university system, despite our structure. We don't share a lot of uniform structure, and this is the whole point is to provide for greater coordination. We do an outstanding job right now, and they were just surprised by it, and so they wanted to try and create a structure that would make it so that that was a natural conclusion. Because we think that our partners in the community college sector and in K-12 do an outstanding job, and really what this is about is not the individual sectors, but the gaps in between, and so that we don't lose students as they transfer, and so we can try and figure out a way to be able to better achieve the goals of the 40-40-20. So what I've told you is that 2118 is the OUS governance proposal. Senate Bill 242 has two functional differences, which is the no local boards requirement piece, institutional board discussion, and the addition of the coordinating board. So that's the only difference. I'm happy to answer any questions about that. I would say that there have been some positions of support taken by a variety of folks that we are very proud of engaging with them and getting that support. The first and most important of which, I think, is that the Oregon Student Association has endorsed the Senate Bill 242. We think that any important change that happens in higher education, that the most affected constituent should definitely be at the table. And the fact that they are supportive is very meaningful to us. Further, all of the university presidents have endorsed and voted, signed a letter of support for what is functionally House Bill 2118 and been encompassed in 242, which is the OUS governance proposal. The State Board of Higher Education has also taken a position of support. The OBA, PBA, AOI, and OBC wrote a letter of endorsement, the business community, because they also believe, as folks who run businesses and realizing universities are somewhat similar to large businesses, they think that some of these changes are absolutely critical, and they also want to make sure that we can educate a highly educated workforce. Finally, I believe SEIU has also submitted a letter of endorsement. So that's all I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but in case you have any questions about the amendments to Senate Bill 242, Ryan Hegeman is here to answer those questions or just briefly summarize any of those major changes, if you have any.
Thank you, Bridget. Rep. Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, so the OUS, the State Board of Higher Education, is encouraging us to pursue 242, right?
That is correct.
And do they have a position on 2118?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, 2118 and 242 for us functionally accomplished both of our primary goals, which our primary goal was the Oregon University System Governance Proposal. And so both are supported by our Board of Higher Education. However, we feel that Senate Bill 242 is the appropriate vehicle to advance that because it has such broad sweeping support and has had the appropriate amendments incorporated to satisfy a variety of interested parties. And I know that there are some ongoing discussions about other issues, and I think that those that it seems to be the appropriate vehicle that has a lot of support, and we would choose that as the vehicle.
Thank you.
Bridget, I wonder if you might talk about OSAC. You mentioned that they were obviously impacted by 242 in a way that they're not in 2118. How are they enfolded in there? And just tell me about how all that happens, again, procedurally, with what happens with their governance, their oversight, their employees, and all that kind of stuff.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, in terms of OSAC, I was not very involved in this particular process, so I can speak to you about what I know and my familiarity, but I would defer to Senator Haas in terms of how they see this actually taking place. Functionally, I've been told, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission will continue to exist in terms of what it accomplishes, Aspire, the variety of scholarships and grants that it provides. It administers the CHAPE grant, which is the grant for former foster youth. And so I'm under the impression that those services will continue, but it will be swept in under this coordinating board. And so what the functional, it appears that the substantive change is that the actual commission, the, I believe, seven appointed members who provide oversight for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, that portion goes away, but that they would provide, they would be provided oversight from the coordinating board that would be replacing that board. It's difficult to talk about because OSAC in its title is the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and so that's the agency and also the name of the commission. So, but the commission part is the only part that would be removed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just speak to that. The elimination of the volunteer citizen commission to OSAC is one piece of 242 that troubles me. And Rep. Johnson and I have met with members of that board. Representative Clem was involved in that. We would like to see that maintained, and we're pursuing a way to have that commission retain its functions under the auspices of either the coordinating commission or the governor's P20 investment board, which we heard about the other day, most likely under the coordinating commission at this point. But we're having conversations. We met with legislative council about how we can do that. We just have to find the proper vehicle and either amend a bill or submit a new bill, which I'm prepared to do.
Chair Johnson, Representative Dembro, members of the committee, I think that will be appreciated. I think there are a lot of folks who are who share your concerns, and it's a particularly interesting position for me because I'm a former chair of OSAC, as is Representative Clem, was also the former chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So we have a particular insight into the functions of that group, and I don't know if he had anything to add, but I look forward to seeing what you develop.
Thank you. I will add, Mr. Chair, if I can, that there is some talk about actually changing the name of the body to, instead of being the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, calling it something like the Oregon Student Access something that begins with C.
Council, committee.
Council, committee, something. But shifting the focus from assistance to access, which is really what it's all about, I think, is expanding access to more Oregonians.
One thing I noticed, and I could be reading this incorrectly, that's certainly possible, but there's not a lot of specificity, I guess, in terms of the membership of the coordinating commission. As I read here, it says that basically members of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission must be residents of the state who are well informed on the principles of higher education. I just noticed that, in regards to other boards, there's a lot more specific. In fact, Rep. Dembro's task force that we just were talking about earlier today had some specific these type of individuals and so forth. That to me, it seems a little nebulous. Is that intentional?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I cannot speak to the intention of Senator Haas, but I do think that if you wanted to further flesh out some of the details of that, I'm sure that the conversations would be potentially welcomed.
Thank you. Rep. Clem.
Thank you, first of all, for letting me join you today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Co-chairs. So just in the way of background, I started doing higher ed advocacy in 1993 when I was a college student, and in every session since then I've been involved in one way or another as either a field representative for Senator Wyden that include Oregon State, a commission chair, or I was vice chair of this committee when we last had it in 07. And so the particular point that I just want to make isn't actually about the OSEC part yet. Back in, I think it was 95 session, I was staffing a faculty member from Oregon State who was also a state senator, and I remember sitting through the discussions of sort of public corporation model for OHSU, and one thing I want to note is I have heard no characterization from anybody involved in this proposal that they would never be back for more money or never need help again, which was a huge sticking point for some members with OHSU at one point. Was we felt like the relationship was over and we would never need to be helpful to them again in 95 if the state just severed it. That's been completely off the table here. I mean, what I hear is give us more flexibility, you'll get more accountability, but I don't hear allusions to the fact that we may not need to give them any appropriations in the future because they can solve all their own problems. And that was, you'll hear some members who have been around the legislature since that time still feel like they got burned then. I heard some of those statements made myself from advocates for this model. I have not heard any of that from the higher ed model. So it's important to know that this model has worked, but we need to expect that we will still need a partnership and we'll still need to keep appropriating funds to these systems while giving them greater flexibility. There was another session, either 97 or 99, when Grattan Cairns was working with the system, and they talked about more flexibility. It just never happened. So this is long overdue. Mm-hmm. The flexibility components, in my view at least, are long overdue. On the OSAC part particularly, and I think that Bridget should decide for herself whether she wants to comment on it as a former chair, but having watched a little bit of the interim process and been alerted to potential changes to OSAC, I called and asked some members questions. At that time, I don't think what the language and you'll see in the bill was being even envisioned yet. But the way the bill reads, until you see some amendments to the contrary, I don't think it's just the commission abolished the members. It's everything and all their assets transferred. And so I don't think it's just the volunteers spoken to currently. I know functionally what's been said, the theory is behind it, but that's not what the bill reads right now. So then, and I want to thank the chairs for coming and sitting in with a lot of the stakeholders for the commission, because then the question becomes, why change the name? Why do anything? Is there some really good policy reason to do it? Are we saving some money? Something like that. And what's at risk by even tampering with something that's worked very well for decades? And I have yet to hear an explanation other than to get rid of one commission, to start a new commission, we felt like we had to get rid of another one. And that's literally the best answer and most honest answer I've heard so far. Watching the Ford Foundation and the Oregon Community Foundation start realizing the tens of millions of dollars that they give to students every year may be in jeopardy because they're not sure who would go find their scholarship recipients for them the way OSAC does. To me, that would be a big sign that somebody should have asked more questions before they just threw this in a bill and got a bunch of our big, important foundations nervous about the future of their scholarship programs. Secondly, the bill doesn't speak to rulemaking authority, which is what the commission has. And so not only does it hire and fire the exec director, it decides the minutiae of whether a student's assets would count against them during their financial aid process or not, or what the hydraulics should be for when they run out of money in the middle of the year. Do they come running to eBoard, or does OSAC itself, those commissioners, do they make the cuts and send the award letters out to students saying, sorry, we're cutting your scholarship in the middle of the year? None of that is spoken to in the bill. So unless this new commission wants to get into that level of minutiae rather than the theory I read about, which is broadly figuring out policy between the community colleges, you're going to have a body that is doing the minutiae, or you're going to have to give it all to unelected, unappointed, unconfirmed staff and just have the staff make all those decisions, and there would not be a body of appointed people that the legislature can weigh in on through the confirmation process to help guide those things. So that's my little soliloquy. on OSAC, but obviously it's worked well. It's how I got to go to college in the first place when I was 17 years old, getting scholarships and grants. I was chair of it for 6 years. And just to get rid of one commission and get another is a terrible reason to ruin something like that commission. If there's a better policy reason, I'm still waiting to hear it personally. And I got to thank you for having this hearing, because this bill may not have ever been considered by a House Policy Committee otherwise. And when I talked to one of our Ways and Means subcommittee chairs, she said, well, we're not supposed to be talking policy once it gets there. So if you hadn't done this, I'm not sure any of this would have ever gotten on the record. So, again, thank you so much for letting me intrude on your committee for the afternoon.
Thank you, Representative Clem. You're always welcome. I wish you had your afternoons fully taken up. You can be an ad hoc member of this committee anytime. Getting to your comments, though, addressing your comments about the what happens to those functions and so forth, and if getting away with one, doing away with one agency or one committee, and you know, is that the justification for it? But I noticed in Section 7 it gives the Coordinating Commission may establish such advisory and technical committees as it considers necessary to aid and advise the Commission in performance of its functions, which, again, is kind of a gray area, I guess. But, again, if I'm not sure that that is what you're referring to, but the Commission would have the ability to adopt or form other committees that could provide some of this expertise perhaps they are anticipating they may need, but not clearly spelled out, I guess, is what I see in that policy there. Bridget, were you going to walk us through the amendments to 242?
Chair
that
Johnson.
That might be helpful just to see what's been proposed, or whomever, but
yeah.
That would be great just to see what's, because I think that some of these may refer to what perhaps Rep. Clem's been addressing, maybe not, but maybe so.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, this is, again, Ryan Hageman, the OUS Legal Counsel, who is going to be happy to walk you through all the various amendments.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. For the record, my name is Ryan Hageman, and I am legal counsel to the Oregon University System. To answer that question really quickly, the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 242 do not appear to substantively address any of these OSAC issues. And so,
thank you.
I would characterize most, if not all of them, as transition or housekeeping types of amendments. And you'll see in the chart that we prepared, comparing the two, the Senate Bill 242 and House Bill 2118, in addition to the two substantive changes that Bridget spoke of earlier with regard to institutional boards and then the commission in 242, another one through the amendment process was the addition in 242 of a labor management committee to discuss any potential changes to group health health benefits. And then that was further amended by the Dash 8s, but that's another change that was in 242 that was not initially in 2118. But if I were to group them, you'll see, you know, I tried to be high level on that column for you, and I would be more than happy to get into them. I believe you also might have a copy of the actual Dash 8s. I'm not sure if...
Just a summary or
that's,
the actual...
That's even better, actually.
We have the full.
But a substantial portion of the amendments, this was also a collaborative process through talking to our colleagues in other agencies, such as the Department of Justice, Treasury, PERS, a variety of agencies, and a collaborative process to do so. But because the Oregon University System still maintains the relationship, as Bridget points out, to the Treasury, for example, a lot of amendments were surrounded about making sure that we were precise in the applicability of certain banking statutes and Treasury statutes that would be necessary for us to continue that relationship with regard to general obligation bonds and revenue bonds and credit enhancement devices, very technical stuff. And so worked substantially with Treasury and the Department of Justice. And so you'll see a lot of transition about the old board is a continuation of the new board and the old OUS is a continuation of the new OUS, maintains a relationship with Treasury. Also a lot of discussion about how, because the Department of Justice would still be the Treasury's attorney, how those costs would be reimbursed for any activity or bonding that would have to do with us. So a lot of indemnity, transition, State Board takes responsibility for its liabilities, clarifying legal services, and the relationship with the Treasurer are a big bundle of those amendments. That's kind of one group. and I try to identify them in the correct space to give a little bit more precision. Another group of amendments had to do with a lot of clarifications, not only with the Oregon University system, but community colleges and the Oregon Health Sciences University vis-a-vis the commission. So a lot of kind of clarification of community colleges, talking about tuition with their governing boards, adding a dimension of consideration of affordability to not only the OUS performance compact, but the consideration of how tuition is the interaction between recommendations from the commission and activities of our board with regard to tuition setting along the process that Bridget described earlier. So there's a group of kind of tweaks or clarifications with exactly how is this new commission overlay with OUS, and you'll see some tweaks there about adding affordability to the performance compact, another dimension to how the interaction with tuition setting occurs, etc. There are some very highly technical, and perhaps the better person to speak to would be your attorney, Gordon. I've worked with him throughout this process, but with regard to PERS, and you'll see a lot of changes in the numbering. Chapter 238 references, those are the PERS references, and so those are pretty definitional and highly technical that came out of his office. And then the final one that I would point out is you might notice that the section of the statute that talks about the performance compact and the submission of a funding request was substantially rewritten, and that was mostly to clarify. So the interaction between the commission's consideration of the funding request, the attachment of the performance compact, and how that would be included possibly in the governor's recommended budget. So that was just rewritten to establish clarification more than anything. Those are kind of the groups, and I'm more than happy to get into the minutia of amendments, but I would say that the vast majority of them came from a transitional point, is making sure that because Senate Bill 242 has an emergency clause, but also has an operative date. So there's a six-month window for a lot of these major changes to occur. And so through collaboration with other agencies, DOJ, Treasury, DAS, we started kind of really being precise about the necessary transition language that would need to facilitate those discussions over the 6 months if this were to pass.
Thank you. Any other questions for anyone of these panel here? I think, as Senator Haas said the other day, that the original version of 242 had been shot full of holes, and the amendments were kind of to plug those holes that were taken at it from various entities. I guess in my mind, I'm still. I noticed that one of the things I think that is in both 242 the. And it's commonality in both 242 and 2118 is the expansion of the state board. There's some additional, you go from board of 12 to board of 15 under both bills. Is that correct?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay. Was that a response to just wanting to become more inclusive and add more types of people, I think? Was there additional student access? Was that one of the reasons for expanding the board?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, that in addition to about two and a half years ago, the board substantially reorganized itself into having three major standing committees. And so is the thought as this discussion went forward, just to have more people and more perspectives and the possibility of different geographic regions of the state, but also to make sure that those committees were robust, and over the last two and a half years the board has really asked a lot of its standing committees, and I think one of the motivations was not only to enhance diversity and representation of different folks across the state, but also just to have more people to help with that current structure.
Okay. Very good. Welcome back, Rep. Springer. Well, I guess that's any other questions of these. We have other people to testify on behalf of this. So if you guys will stay around, I'm sure there may be other questions that come up you can address. Let me bring John Wyckoff up now. Please.
Can I borrow your card first?
Oh, sure. Okay. Can I plug it in?
Put it on my tab.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. Thank you for the opportunity to provide the community college perspective on Senate Bill 242. We've been involved with the process since it began earlier this summer in the interim committee. there were sort of three major areas that I think were where they heard from the consultants on what a sort of big look policy commission or council should do, that our membership and concept really agreed were sort of worthy for this commission to look at. And they were essentially looking at what the investment should be for the various parts of higher education, looking at possibly targeted investments to meet the state's goals in furthering 40-40-20, or looking at specific areas where there might be holes in the workforce or other areas where we needed improvement, and then creating performance measures to measure how well state dollars are being spent. And that kind of big look policy discussion we think is valuable for the state, is valuable for the legislature, is valuable for the citizen and taxpayer to know that their money is being spent well and that we're using it efficiently. And I should say we in the first versions of the bill, there were some changes that we felt needed to be made in terms of keeping the integrity of the ability of locally elected community college boards to still exercise initiative and autonomy around local governance. And I really need to thank Senator Haas and the members of the Senate Education and Workforce Committee for working with us throughout this process, because we really believe that the that our locally elected college boards are an absolute asset to the community college system, and that they in no way need to be mutually exclusive of the goals here, that they really actually augment the goals of the broad goals of this council. And so we've had a really productive relationship there, trying to make sure that key areas such as control over tuition and the ability of local locally elected boards to really be governing the colleges, that those stay intact. And so most of those issues have been resolved. There are just a few issues that I think we still have to resolve that some of you have heard about today, and one actually is quite technical that I'll talk briefly about. One of the things that we have fairly recently discovered is when it appears that I think legislative council was going through and trying to make the language in the bill consistent around PERS. And so essentially what they did was use the OUS definition of what makes a part-time employee eligible for PERS. And by part-time in this context, we mean more than half-time, but less than full-time. And applying, so then under the Dash 8 amendments that were adopted, the definition for community colleges would now be the OUS definition, which we believe would drop an awful lot of our members out of the system, so they wouldn't be eligible for either PERS or OPSERP. And it really just comes down to a different way that we calculate those and the different kinds of work that our faculty do. It's a different, there are just different parts of the job in each of the sectors, and they both have different responsibilities. But we also just calculate it very differently. So it's really a technical change. Incidentally, it is also, this has actually happened before in 2003 when they added OPSERP or Tier 3. This actually happened where the OUS language was used, and then in 2005 we had to restore the language that deals directly with community colleges so that our members would still be able to participate in the retirement program. So that is one thing we'll be trying to address. The second is around language that that the Oregon Student Association added to get the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to do a biennial look at affordability, essentially. And currently, the language we think is missing an element. Essentially, what it does is it asks the Ways and Means Committee to look at, I'll just read from it, to review tuition affordability on the basis of standards, including the Higher Education Price Index, medium family income, and state appropriations made to public universities and community colleges in the state. We first think that enrollment growth may be missing from that, that one of the drivers for something like a tuition increase could be enrollment. And so if you're really looking at why enrollment has gone up as to a certain number, yes, the state appropriation is very important, because if that goes down 20%, and you're obviously we may need to go beyond the higher education price index. However, if your enrollment goes up 20% and your state share only goes up 5% or goes down 5%, we just think there's a missing element there that's really, really critical if you're looking at what's going on with tuition. So we would ask that that be a part of the conversation. If we're going to have a mandated conversation, that we need to look at all of the elements that play into, that affect price.
Okay, that's a quick question.
Sure.
The items you're addressing, I'm assuming these are in that portion of 242 that are different than what we find in 2118. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay. Just for the record, thank you.
Yeah, and this is really more around, I mean, when you're talking about the coordinating commission piece, although this actually would happen at the Joint Ways and Means, this wouldn't be at the coordinating commission. So that would be a piece that we would want to see in there with the enrollment growth. We would also want to ensure that, especially in the context of the community college system, that having a conversation about what the maximum, and that's the word that's used, that the maximum tuition increase would not apply a de facto cap for local boards. That we would want to have it clear in the record that is a conversation for purposes of looking at what the state appropriation needs to be and things like performance measures and modeling, but that it is not intended to be a de facto cap on tuition and to remove the local authority there. But part of addressing that, we believe, is adding the enrollment growth, because that's just an important missing aspect. So those are just some areas of concern we have there that we look forward to working with the student association to be able to come to an agreement and find language that we can all agree on.
Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you. So, John, just to clarify, so when you talk about the effect of enrollment growth, so are you saying that you have a fixed allocation because we don't get funded? I'm sorry, you don't get funded. We don't fund you by student, per student, but you get a fixed amount of money, and so if there are more students, then the per student allocation goes down.
That's right.
And you have costs that can't be covered because of that.
Absolutely, yeah. Chair Johnson, that's absolutely how that occurs, and it's something we see all the time. And in fact, in the governor's budget, he was very careful. He outlined what his budget level would bring our per student funding down to, and then obviously, if you get tremendous enrollment growth, that per student funding number goes down even further because you're just serving more students with the same pie. The last piece that I wanted to touch on gets at what Representative Clem brought up, and I just that is an issue for our colleges where there has been an amount of concern, and I think that we're encouraged that there are conversations going on to make sure that the capacity that the commission, and by the commission I mean the Student Assistance Commission, the actual committee, that the capacity they bring to do the day-to-day regulatory work. I go to all the Student Assistance Commission meetings for the most part, and I can tell you they're monthly. They get into the weeds. They do the day-to-day regulatory and management of the program that I just don't think is what you're looking for in a big picture policy committee. I just don't think they're that congruent. And Representative Clem was absolutely right. I mean, they're looking at very specific hydraulics on a monthly basis. They're looking at the number of applications that come in. So it's the kind of work that absolutely has to go on for the effective management of the program. And so we're really encouraged that there seems to be an acknowledgement of this, and that capacity to have some body that is able to complete that work, where you have volunteer members who are coming to both look at what the difference hydraulics should be, but also to sort out between the different sectors, between the independent private sector, the four-year sector, and the two-year sector. We often have different opinions about which is the right lever to pull and which is the right way to set cutoff dates and any number of issues. And that what that commission is really there for is to sort of sort that out when you have three sectors that don't always agree, and I think they serve that role. And so we're just encouraged that there's a recognition that you still need that capacity for the effective management of the program, and that it doesn't be seen as something that is incongruent with 242 and the work that they're trying to do there, that it actually should complement what are the goals of Senate Bill 242. And with that, I will conclude and take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for John? Rep. Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Community College Association, I'm in receipt of a letter from my local president saying that they had become supportive of 242, still
had not taken a position on the OSAC portion. Have they since, and I don't know the answer to this, have they since taken a position, the OCCA and the 17 schools, or just issued what you just said, some concerns?
Chair Johnson, Representative Clem, we have not taken, our board has not taken a position on the, an official position on the Student Assistance Commission piece of this legislation, but it's something that our, you know, both our presidents and board members have voiced that they're, that they have a concern over and would want to make sure that we still keep the effective capacity there. But we haven't taken a position on it formally.
One follow-up. So they haven't, and I understand your answer, maybe you can't say this, but since I got you here, and I think we could actually put people under oath if I remember right. You once worked for the Oregon Student Association, you were on the Student Assistance Commission briefly, you now work for the community colleges. Can you see any reason that's useful in either budgetary or policy changes to try and change the name, try and change the history, try and change anything about it that would be helpful to students or anybody that you've once worked for or currently worked for?
one word response, please.
Wow.
Or would ever consider working for
it. You're giving me a lot of grief over
there. I'm glad you wandered in today.
Not 100% sure how to answer that. I mean, I think
waffle.
I think the major thing that we want to make sure that we do here is ensure that the committee and that the commission is intact to do the work that it keeps doing. I know we've had conversations over the years. I think you're getting at a possible name change or something like that. And we've had conversations over the years about what the opportunity grant should be called and what the commission should be called. And my honest answer is, I don't have a huge opinion about that one way or the other. Well, I guess what I would say is, if we're going to make a name change, let's do it in a way that doesn't cost them a lot of money changing stationery, because it seems like this probably won't be the time to do that. Beyond that, I haven't really given it a lot of thought.
Very nice political answer. My hat's off. Thank you for your time today. We appreciate that. We have some other folks who would like to weigh in on this. Emma? And you have some other students also, Keenan and Eric. Please come forward and share with us. Start when you're ready. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Dembro and Johnson. Thanks. For the record, my name is Keenan Weir, and I'm a member of the Oregon Student Association, and I'm here today on behalf of the OSA Board of Directors. As you all hopefully know, we represent over 100,000 students in the public institutions of higher learning across the state. We don't have a stance right now on HB 2118 nor HB 3418 at this time. But we would like to bring forward some points to consider, and at this time we believe that the best option for our higher education system is Senate Bill 242, which we unanimously support. I would like to start with why we are supporting Senate Bill 242. First and foremost, restructuring of Oregon's higher education system needs to include all stakeholders in order to best strategize how we will succeed as a unified system dedicated to supporting all Oregonians. Furthermore, achieving a post-secondary education degree does require more flexibility. Fewer and fewer students are graduating from the same institution that they started. And I can say that I've changed my mind about which university that I would like to go to a couple times. I think it's PSU at the moment. So more and more students are starting at community colleges and transferring into public institutions. So with limited financial aid dollars, we need to think about how financial aid can be maximized and which students are in need of it most. So with all of these factors in mind, we believe the Coordinating Commission, detailed in Senate Bill 242, is the strongest idea that we have on the table in this session, and it is a part that is clearly missing in HB 2118. So if we were going to support House Bill 2118, we believe some of the changes that were made in Senate Bill 242 would need to be included in 2118. Our first priority is maintaining the legislature's role in reviewing tuition affordability. Rising tuition costs are directly relating to diminishing general fund allocation. OSA has brought forward an amendment to Senate Bill 242 that requires the Legislative Assembly through Committee on Ways and Means to review financial indicators like the median family income and higher education consumer price index. We were just talking about this. These factors would give Ways and Means the opportunity to weigh in on tuition, weigh in on tuition affordability if necessary. But most importantly, Ways and Means will be able to directly associate increasing tuition with diminishing general fund allocations. So in the same vein, we believe that, or we believe in the value of a statewide accountable system, local governing boards that don't include elected officials are not in the best interest of students. A statewide structure allows for cost sharing, unified transition between institutions, and the mechanisms necessary to achieve our statewide goals of 40-40-20. And so lastly, we traditionally support the needs of our faculty and staff in the amendments that they have put forward, as we believe great education starts with great educators. I will now turn it over to Eric Richardson, who is the Associate Students of Lane Community College's Multicultural Program Coordinator, to explain some other considerations. We're happy to continue to come to the table and discuss the much-needed changes to our higher education system. Thank you very much.
Okay. Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Dembro, as he said, my name is Eric Richardson, and I'm also a board member of the Oregon Student Association, and specifically a member of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition. I'm here today to share just a few more thoughts, things to consider about this bill. As a student of Lane Community College, we have local boards, but we believe they are accountable to our communities because of some of our members, their members are elected. HB 2118 gives the OUS the authority to set up local boards for our major institutions if they choose, and we believe this is a power that should be reserved for our legislative assembly for them to decide. As Keenan mentioned, we believe that SB 242 is the best structure for higher education in Oregon this session. I would be remiss if we did not mention that SB 559, the new U of O partnership, is also up for debate this session. SB 599 would give the University of Oregon the right to add armed police officers to the University Department of Public Safety. And secondly, if the University of Oregon was removed from the OUS system, the U of O would no longer be have to accept credits from community colleges or even consider accepting transfer students. In my case, that would be a tragedy. This may not have been the intention of this legislation, but this is an egregious admission. We want to thank the Representative Clem on his position of about OSAC. Students have voted to support a committee for OSAC, and as we know that financial aid needs detailed monitoring. We also believe that the coordinating commission may be too large of an entity to manage the work of OSAC. As we move forward, we hope that as you debate these bills over the coming months, that you will value the vital role of the Legislative Assembly to engage in important statewide debates. We want to leave this idea of your engagement in these statewide debates to the Legislative Assembly, especially in SB 242 and SB HB 2118. In conclusion, we are concerned with the appointed local governing boards. We want something like the coordinating commission to bring together statewide stakeholders and find cost savings for all institutions. We want statewide debates like arming public safety officers and transfer systems to be left to the Legislative Assembly. Please help us find a cost-effective and accountable system for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Emma, do you have anything to add, or are you just there to support?
I'm just here in support and to make sure I answer questions. For the record, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for OSA. If I could add for a second, we will be working with the community colleges to address their concerns around our amendment, but we also stand strongly on the fact that we have one amendment in SB 242, and we do want to continue to maintain a conversation for community colleges and universities on all the indicators that play into tuition affordability. So we're open to those conversations, but we really do stand on the value of that amendment, and we look forward to further discussions and further participation, and we're here to just answer any questions you may have from the student perspective.
Great. Any questions for our outstanding student, Rep. Dembro?
I do have a question. Eric, you mentioned, and Emma, I know you have mentioned to me in the past, that, you know, the OSA's opposition to local boards in universities. Are you opposed to would you be willing to be part of a conversation around local boards? Because I think that is a subject that needs to be discussed and debated. I do agree, and I think this is what you said, Eric, that it should not be a decision of the State Board of Higher Education. It's a legislative decision. I do believe that. And I appreciate the State Board's willingness to discuss this issue, but realistically, it's going to discuss this issue from its own perspective. You know, I mean, it's going to create that context for the conversation. And so I think it is important for us to create a way for people who have a variety of opinions on local boards, you know, including people who can give us a national perspective on this, to come together and help us debate this issue. And I'm considering some legislation that might help us to do that. But I guess the question is your sense that you're so opposed to it that you don't even want to talk about it? Not to put you on the spot, but...
Well, Co-Chair Dembro and representatives, I believe that this is dialogue is always good, and so therefore I wouldn't be just completely against that. I mean, we do want to be able to continue a conversation no matter what way this goes, but we feel pretty strongly about having elected representatives there and not appointed people on these boards. And I guess that's what you meant when you said national figures and whatnot. You're talking about appointed figures, so. And I also ask you to hype up on that, but that'd basically be my take on it personally.
Yeah, just to answer his question, when I mentioned national people, I meant, you know, people who are looking at other states and, you know, which may have local boards or not, and which are the preferable models, which seem to be working better. You know, what are the upsides, what are the downsides? And just to get that kind of perspective, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so for basically how I am looking at it is basically, of course, any perspective, any kind of advice we could get would be welcome. But the main stance is about just having an elected board in general. So we're pretty solid on that stance, yes.
Can I also, please? So OSA is constantly moving towards wanting to participate more in these conversations. So I would say that, yes, we would like to participate. We think that that's very valuable. But I would also say that we do need to be looking at what's on the table right now for local boards, and SB 559 and the New York U of O New Partnership has an elected board that has, or has an appointed board that is much further away from what we can see in any other state in terms of being accountable to the public. And so that is concerning to us. We would want to say that we would hope that conversation would happen afterwards, and we wouldn't be passing bills that we'd have to somehow pull back from later, because as we can see in Texas and other states, that's very challenging for states to do.
So you're comfortable, however, with OSAC being absorbed by the coordinating council that comes out of 242, which is an elected, or not an, it's not an elected board, that's an appointed board that takes over some of that oversight and so forth. So just help me clarify why you're comfortable with that model versus how it currently is.
Okay. Well, as far, from what I heard today, that basically the clarification that Representative Clem was speaking towards is of concern to us. And as far as we move forward, I would basically like Emma to talk about that, but I think this is something that we are concerned about too. Okay.
If I can, Representative Johnson, there's a large difference between a local governing board for us and the allocation of OSAC dollars in terms of who is appointed to do that work. And we think that OSAC works wonderfully right now with appointed boards. They have a higher percentage of student involvement than any other committee or commission in the state, and we think that that's very valuable. With local governing boards that govern universities and address much larger concerns about the student experience, the student lifestyle, tuition, other factors, we think that that should be left to an accountable system that often does very well with elected officials. We think that fundraising boards, foundations, and other things can be done incredibly well with universities, but we think when it comes to the governing of our universities, we want a statewide system first and foremost, and we would want elected officials after that.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding tuition, if we had guaranteed tuition, if one of the local boards offered that, would that solve at least that portion of the concern?
Co-Chair Johnson and Representative Lindsay, I think that that's an amendment that's being proposed in the U of O New Partnership that we're interested in looking into, but there's nothing in the U of O New Partnership that says that they wouldn't be able to come back and ask for further general fund allocations. And we think that when we're talking about general fund allocation, taxpayer dollars, we want to be able to have elected officials very much involved in that process. And that amendment that you're speaking to, or an example of that, is still being worked out, and we're anxious to see how that would actually work.
Question. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to say anything, but since we got into it, I was a OSA chair myself when I was in college, and one thing to make sure that your board members know is this committee, I don't believe, will have Senate Bill 242 in front of it, doesn't sound like. When you said you support the bill, you know currently in the bill there is no such committee that you referenced that you might feel okay with, and the chairs are interested in pursuing that. It's going to be up to a different committee and whether they will entertain policy amendments or not at that point. So as you mentioned, OSAC currently has the commission has currently the highest percentage of student involvement in it. The bills it's written has zero student involvement. So is it really accurate to say that OSA supports 242, including the OSAC provisions as they currently stand, or you're hearing talk of maybe something that may occur later that you might be able to live with?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Clem, we support 242 as it's written now. That's how my students voted on that particular bill. And then we took a supplementary vote to also support the OSAC conversations, and we believe that that's an incredibly important part. We decided, honestly, to move forward with 242 because our students wanted to look at the overarching 30,000 foot picture and wanted to support that bill because we don't want to support other bills as well. We want to make it very clear which pathway we think is best, and we are going to continue to have conversations. So unfortunately, although we don't feel like OSAC's needs have been resolved, we support 242 as it stands, and we want to move forward with conversations about OSAC, and we think that that's very important, and we're stuck between a rock and a hard place on that.
Just one follow-up, please. But no one could characterize you accurately as being in support of just abolishing the Student Assistance Commission membership, and that's where you're at. You had some supplemental discussion that you want to see something addressed like the co-chairs talked about at some point.
Representative Johnson, Representative Clem, yes, absolutely. You cannot characterize the Oregon Student Association as not supporting OSAC and a committee that works on that minutia and getting into the weeds, as other people have talked about. So thank you very much for clarifying. We absolutely support a committee that would be able to function and go through the day-to-day work that OSAC does, which is so incredibly vital to our state and financial aid programs.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And again, I would say that we are working on this problem, and we will find a solution to it. We're committed to maintaining the life of the OSAC commission, the committee. We cannot promise them any more compensation than they're currently getting, which is zero. But we we want to find a way for them to continue to work for free. The other thing I will remind you of is Senate Bill 242 is now in Ways and Means, or it's headed to Ways and Means, where it will sit in the Education Subcommittee, and Rep. Springer is one of the co-chairs of that committee. I'm one of the, I don't know if I'm a co-vice chair or a vice co-chair, something. Anyway, I'm on that committee too. And so, if it's the inclination of this committee to be supportive of finding a solution to OSAC, I would be happy to carry that, and I'm sure Rep. Springer would as well.
Emma, I wonder if I might ask you, this is probably beyond what we're talking about today, but as the students look at and see the governor's ideas for his P20 investment board, and there's still some pieces to be to put together into that puzzle and so forth, but I'm just wondering from the students' perspective what their thoughts are about that model and perhaps how that could interact with the legislation we're currently examining right here, whether that seems like a logical fit or a good natural transition, or just share whatever you feel from the students' perspective that you know.
Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. I'm no longer a student, so I always check with my students before I answer the question. I work for them. I think that we think a number of things. First of all, we don't have a stance on the pre-K through 20 investment board, so I always like to lead with that. Second of all, we think that what's missing from 242 is an idea for additional revenue. We all know that we need to be finding creative funding sources, and we don't necessarily think that the bonding proposed in 559 is maybe the best option, but we do think that other creative options are important, and the investment board would address those concerns, so we're excited to continue conversations around that. We do think that 242 fits nicely under the investment board, as it would create a seamless system and have appropriate hierarchy from looking down on the OUS system being able to look at day-to-day and the coordinating commission being able to look at that 30,000-foot level. So we think that they play nicely into each other. What we don't want is a pre-K through 20 board that then has a myriad of local boards with all different regulations and all different structures underneath it, because we think that that would be incredibly difficult to handle, and we think that, again, a statewide system allows us to use interest earnings as a team and as a group. It allows us to look at financial aid from a holistic perspective across what all our universities and students need, and so what we would want to steer away from is an investment board with I guess the analogy that comes to mind is too many tentacles underneath. And we think that clear and seamless collaborative work needs to happen underneath something of that magnitude. Does that help answer your question at all?
Yeah, great. I know you guys are looking ahead, which I assumed you were.
Always.
Any further questions or comments?
Rep. Well.
I just have a question to something you referenced before about the U of O proposal, saying that your concerns were, one, you talked about your concerns about campus safety. I completely understand that. And then also your concerns about if that proposal goes through and is made law, that there would be then no ability for or limited ability, or your concern that there would be less ability for people to transfer credits back and forth. And in that bill, it does say in Section 51, the State Board of Higher Education, in coordination with the University of Oregon, shall enact performance benchmarks for the university. And within those performance benchmarks that are proposed, one is making sure that we have a benchmark for underrepresented enrollment so that we don't change the change the demographics of the students that go there. Campus safety, academic quality, and also specifically making sure that we have the kind of integration that we need within the university system so that we can transfer credits and on our community college system. So were you aware of that?
Of that particular language?
Yes, sir.
That was in there. No, I when I read this, I was not aware of that, but that does, let me read exactly what I read here. So, no. So, I was just...
Well, and I think it's an important thing, and I think that it's really important that students are involved in the discussion, regardless of where you land on whether you support or don't support this project or this proposal. I think that your voices are really important, but understand that people are taking those concerns, that they're valid concerns, and people are listening, and that there are people at the table that have said these are very important and we don't want to move forward unless those concerns are addressed.
All right, so thank you very much for that clarification.
Thank you, Rep. Boyle, for that. Emma, follow up?
Yes, please. Representative Hoyle, we mean no disrespect to the proposal at all in that process. Our concern is right now is that the Oregon University system is able to look at all universities transferring between them, and the Coordinating Commission would be able to look at community colleges and universities and be moving towards a better transfer system. And so it's possible that if the U of O was removed so far from the system that we may lose some of that potential for better transferring among universities and that accountability between universities and across the state. That was what we meant by that.
Well, with no further input, I guess that'll conclude our time for today. So appreciate you all being here, and everybody that's had a chance to weigh in on these issues and these bills. As has been said, Senate Bill 242 is not on a trajectory that would bring it before a policy committee in the House. 2118 remains in front of us. We'll need to determine what our course is as we go forward. Rep. Denver.
Mr. Chair, if I can just say, I am proud to say that we as a committee have discussed Senate Bill 242 as much as the Senate has, actually. You know, we were with them for the entirety of their public hearing on 242. We missed some of the amendment conversation, but I can assure you that we have been able to be engaged no less than they.
And thank you so much.
We are adjourned.
No.